right, so today we're going to be talking about Michael Servetus. He is from your textbook, page number 337. You're going to see that he is seen as the forefather of the Unitarian faith, the Unitarian way of believing. That's what I mean by faith, a way of believing. Here in just a moment, we're going to play a short video, and it is just a tad corny. The link will be available on the sermon audio recording that will be posted on the class Facebook page today before everyone runs to their igloos for the evening. So page 337, the beginnings of Unitarianism as a movement may be traced almost immediately to the radical anti-Trinitarian of the 16th century. Particularly the one who is active on the continent. Here we are. Here's the one we're talking about today. Servetus, an anti-Trinitarian who was burned at the stake in 1553, is often seen as the direct forerunner or even the founder of the Unitarian movement. All right. And then we're probably not going to talk about Faustus Socinus, however you want to pronounce that. I'm sure there's a correct way, and I'll probably get a nasty grammar about how I pronounce that. But in any case, we're going to be talking about this cat here for a few minutes today, Michael Servetus.
Michael Servetus, bright, educated, and very intelligent. He lived when the Renaissance was in full swing and the Protestant Reformation had begun. No better time? For Servetus, it was a formula for death. Michael Servetus was born in Aragon, Spain in 1511. He studied Latin, Hebrew, and Greek, and was very gifted in them.
Born in Spain. Went to the university at the age of 13. Went out to school, went to another university at the age of 16.
At the urging of his father, he studied law at the University of Toulouse. Regardless of where he was or what he was doing, his vast interest in areas of study caused him to think deeply. Before he was 21 years old, he began publishing. Reading the Bible, he was surprised that the Trinity was not explicitly stated or defined.
Michael Servetus studied the Bible, and he realized he studied it. The Trinity was not in the Bible. It's not in the Bible at all.
In July of 1531, he published On the Errors of the Trinity. He believed God is one and that he was not three persons. He wrote that Jesus was the manifestation of this one God as a man and what is called the Son. The invention of the printing press had loosed thought and discussion. In the following months, he published Dialogues on the Trinity, and On the Justice of Christ's Reign. To no avail, his books were confiscated and was sought after by the Spanish Inquisition.
He believed that Jesus was the Son of the Eternal God.
He fled to France and took the pseudonym Michael of Villanueva to avoid persecution. Servetus went on to Paris to study mathematics and medicine, and worked 12 years as a physician in Vienna. He was the first doctor to challenge and scientifically argue against the theories of Galen, which had predominated medical schools worldwide for 14 centuries, most notably and correctly about the pulmonary circulation of the blood. But all the while, deep in biblical and theological thought, he was preparing his major work called The Restoration of Christianity. In 1546, he began to correspond with chief reformer John Calvin, now pastoring in Geneva, Switzerland. Years later, in 1553, when Servetus finished his restoration work, he sent a copy to Calvin. When Calvin saw it, though it was under a pseudonym, it dawned on him it must be Servetus. And John Calvin turned him in to the Catholic Inquisition in France. Servetus was promptly arrested, thrown in jail, and interrogated. But not for long, because Servetus escaped. But where does he go? He was wanted in Spain and France. He thought, well, I've sent my work to Calvin in Geneva. Perhaps he'll accept me there. And Servetus boldly went to Geneva.
And Michael boldly went to Geneva, to John Calvin's church. And when he arrived at John Calvin's church, he was immediately thrown into jail for his beliefs.
Recognized in Geneva at John Calvin's church, he was arrested and tried for heresy. He was sentenced to burn at the stake. Calvin, in a lame attempt, asked that Servetus be mercifully beheaded. The council insisted he should be burned at the stake.
They were after him all the time because of his belief that he didn't agree with the Trinity. And he was burned at the stake. They turned around, and when he burned him, they put straw on his head and wet it so he would it would burn slower. And they put sulfur on his head so it would burn hotter.
Spectators were impressed by the tenacity of Servetus' faith.
Calvin wanted Michael to say that Jesus is the eternal Son of God. Michael Servetus says, "I believe he is the Son of the eternal God."
On October 27, 1553, perishing in the flames, he is said to have cried out, "O Jesus, Son of the eternal God." A witness to the execution observed that Servetus, defiant to the last, might have been saved had he but called upon Jesus, the eternal Son. Michael Servetus, his life, his passion, came violently to a close. But his testimony and bravery has sparked millions to a faith which upholds the deity of Jesus Christ, yet retains the strict monotheism central to the scripture. No man, when he hath lighted a candle, covereth it with a vessel, or put it under a bed, but setteth it on a candlestick.
All right, so we have a man's... I think you can tell that maybe the producer of that video was kind of pro-Michael Servetus, do you think? And did you notice that there's a difference between the two extremes? And we're going to talk about them here in just a moment. And I think that it's important that we make sure that we address the issue. Is Jesus the eternal Son of God, or is Jesus the Son of the eternal God? Now, there's quite a difference. One is very clear. Now, let's just talk about this for a moment. One says that God is the eternal one, timeless, and that Jesus is his son. The other says that Jesus is the eternal Son of God, so that you have two eternal persons of the Godhead. And of course, Trinitarianism goes even further, doesn't it? Try. So what does that mean about the Holy Spirit? Also eternally existent. Now here's what Michael Servetus came to see. Michael Servetus said, look, how can you be the firstborn of creation? How can you be the first begotten of the sons of men? How can you be a son and be eternally begotten? Here's how this works. John 3:16 says that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God, right? Now, begotten is a pretty simple word until you start playing gymnastics with it. Begotten is used all over the Bible. Matthew chapter 1, for example, says that Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judah, and Judah begat all the way down. Pharaoh's and Zerah of Tamar, and Pharaoh's begat all the way down to begat Jesus, you know, through Mary, if you're talking about Luke 3. But if you're talking about Matthew 1, begat Joseph, who is the husband of Mary, the mother of Christ. And so, begot usually has a very simple meaning. But then we get to John 3:16. We're told that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God. And the question is asked, well, when did Jesus get begotten? In Matthew 1, it has the idea of being born and becoming somebody's son and having all the rights of sonship, S-O-N-S-H-I-P. Well, then, when did Jesus become the Son of God? Well, Calvin and others like him believed in the eternal sonship. In other words, there was never a time when Jesus was not begotten of God. Well, we think of begotten meaning that, you know, at one point, you became someone's child. That's being begotten. Well, those who believe in the eternal sonship of Jesus believe that if you can go as far back in eternity, if you can go far enough back in eternity, you'll find when he was begotten. Okay, well, will you ever get there? Will you? Can you go far enough back? It's eternity, right? That means it's kind of a catch, kind of a catchy way of saying, yeah, he's eternally begotten, meaning that if you go back far enough in eternity, you'll find when he was begotten. Well, no one can. So essentially, he's the eternal begotten Son of God. Since over here there's no time, and over here is where Jesus was begotten, then the whole term, the whole sentence is really kind of misleading, because was is a time-related term, isn't it? Was means past tense, right? So it's kind of misleading. And Michael Servetus says, look, that doesn't make any sense. I'm not going to believe that. I'm not going to believe that he's eternally begotten. No, I'm going to believe that at some point, Jesus became. That he wasn't always around. That he's not eternal. That at one point, he was begotten, and that he is not God, but rather he is the offspring of God, and is thereby still divine, but not God. Now, as we sit here, we might be asking ourselves, is this possible? Is that possible? How can you be the Son of God and not be God? How can you be divine and not be God? Well, why do we even want to talk about terms when we're in Bible class? Why do we want to talk about church history when we're in Bible class? Well, probably because 500 years ago, or thereabout, here's a man that didn't believe correctly about the Bible, people say. And here is what Servetus described as the apparent divinity of Jesus. Apparent. What does apparent mean?
Evident.
Yeah, good. It looks like he is. It looks like Jesus is God. Okay. And here is probably the best demonstration that people would find. Okay? The best demonstration. I've given it to you before. Here it is again. Michael Servetus says that Jesus in the flesh was the reflect. You saw it. He is a manifestation of God in the flesh. Now, he has a good list of verses that he goes to say this. You're like, well, what's the difference between saying Jesus is God and Jesus is the manifestation of God in the flesh? In other words, when God wanted to become a man, he became Jesus. What's the difference? Well, the difference apparently is so sharp that he was burned at the stake for it. Okay, so let's talk about a few of those things. Number one. Couple of facts about Michael Servetus. Number one, he was a physician of high esteem. Where was he born from the video?
Spain,
that's right. And he was found guilty by the Roman Catholic Church of heresy. Heretics died one way. They died through being burned at the stake. Okay. I can give you a list of these references later if you'd like to have them, but I have them listed here if you want to know where I'm getting my facts. Okay. And I might even... Might even put them on the sermon audio recording if you want to check out what I've, where I'm getting my facts, okay? So he was probably one of the first people that was going against general medicine at the time, and he was saying, you know what, there's a circulatory system, the blood actually travels, and it has real healing agencies, and so he was well advanced. Number two, he believed in the union of the church and state was a great apostasy. The union of the church and the state were a great apostasy. Why is that significant? Why does it matter? Sure, yes, but from his perspective, why does it matter? Very precious little going on here in North America that is written in history at that time. So why, from his perspective, would it be significant that the marrying of church and state is an apostasy? Who had a union between church and state? The Pope? Is that what you said? Yeah, that's true. That's the first consideration, is that the Roman Catholic Church was the official church, and in many cases was intertwined with civil authorities, so that if you weren't Catholic, you were in trouble. And so, in the 1500s, something was in full force mentioned in the film called what? The Inquisition. Okay? Yeah, the Reformation was too, I suppose. But the Inquisition, what was happening in the Inquisition? Who was doing the killing? The Roman Catholic Church was hunting people through valley and dale, hunting them down and torturing them because they didn't have the proper beliefs. many of our Baptist forefathers, many free churchers. When I say free church, I'm talking about free of the state. So what happened in 1517 in that area there? What began in 1517? 15, yeah, Protestant Reformation. 1517? Okay, so that's a pretty big year. So what happened in Germany about that time and in the years to follow? Martin Luther. Okay, so Martin Luther does what in Germania, Germany at the time? What ends up be changing in Germany? Say that. Okay, what else? Was the Roman Catholic Church in existence at the time? In Germany at that time? Well, pretty much. Of course, he never said, I'm going to start a new church and it's called the Lutheran Church. Like me starting a church tomorrow called Sturmian. The Sturmian Church. Okay, that'd be a little bit maybe presumptuous. Many people might think that's a little out of order. I would too. But he starts a church. It's not called Lutheran right away, but it's very much like Luther. And so they start saying they're, you know, eventually Lutheran Church. All right, so question, Lutheran Church. What became of it after that? I mean, did they say, you know what, you should be able to believe whatever you want to believe? Is that what happened? No. No, Germany didn't do anything but swap state churches. They kicked the Roman Catholic Church out of there, and Lutheranism, or the new church, became the new state-sponsored church. And by the way, still is. It's tax-funded even today in Germany, yes?
Do Lutheran churches in Fayetteville and the United States, do they believe the same kind of stuff that, you know, back then Martin Luther would have preached?
Well, that's a hard question, Austin. It's a good one, but it's a hard one because there are at least three major strands of Lutheranism in America. And really, there are many more, but three well-known ones. Missouri Synod, Wisconsin Synod, and ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Churches of America. There are many different kinds of Lutheran. It's really not fair for me to say they're all this way. But I do know that in early Lutheran history, Lutheranism became the new Roman Catholic Church for the purposes of saying a new state church. The new government-sponsored church. Well, Servetus was against that. But what was happening over in Geneva? Calvinism. Now, what was happening with Calvin? What was going on with that church? Was that a church that you'd go to if you wanted to? No. It was another state church. And so, if you're Servetus, and you're living around the time that Calvin is a pastor, and yes, even a civil leader in Geneva, and you're causing trouble with civil leadership, which, oh, by the way, is also church leadership, because Calvin felt like it was his responsibility to put a God-led kingdom on earth, known as a, not a democracy, but a...
Theocracy.
Huh?
Theocracy.
Theocracy, good. A God rulership. And so how do you do that? How do you make people obey the Ten Commandments? Well, that means you have to make the civil authorities agree to do what the church leaders say, right? So you still have a state church. It's just not Catholic and it's not Lutheran. And it's not Zwingli. It's Calvin. It's what would become later on the Reformed Church. Okay. Yes, question.
When Constantine made Christianity the only legal religion, listen, right, in the Bible... Would that be a theocracy?
The problem is that Constantine was about as religious as the table you're sitting behind. I mean, he there wasn't much to him. What he wanted more than anything was a peaceful nation. Okay. He's about as Christian as I am Japanese. And the only thing that made him Christian was that he believed in baptism because he wanted everyone under the same canopy. Everyone. You know, he wanted everyone to be, because if you all believe the same thing, you'll fight about less. It was Blaise Pascal, I believe, that said, violence is never done with greater force and greater conviction than when done in the name of religion. So if you can get people to have the same religion, they have less to fight about. And so that was Constantine's goal, was to get the good old-fashioned what that ended in 184, 185-ish back into Rome. What was it called? Pax. Come on, some of you world history.
Pax Romanus,
yes. He wanted that back. He wanted the good old-fashioned glory days of Roman peace. And one way to do that was to get everyone believing the same thing again. So he was for Christian toleration. But Christian domination, he was more concerned about having a kingdom that was peaceful than he was about anything else. And that's why you march whole defeated armies through a river and call them baptized. Okay? All right, so that's exactly what he did. All right, so the biggest problem with Servetus was that he was what we might call an anti-sacramentarian, meaning that he didn't believe that you get grace because of the church's authority. You get grace because of what Christ did. You don't get grace because the church says you have grace. Now, that means something back then, because the church was the one who worked with the civil authorities to make sure there was peace. Remember, if everyone believes the same thing, then there's less to fight about. And so there is good reason for civil authorities to want one religion. And oh, by the way, if you want to tax everyone, then you need to know everyone. Well, that means you have to have an accurate census. So one way that you can have an accurate census is to make it eternally significant if someone doesn't get on it. In other words, if you don't get on this list of people, you go to hell. Well, how do you do that? How do you convince people that if you don't get on this list of people, that we can use to tax you, by the way, how do we convince you to get on that list? Ah, we make it so that you go to hell if you're not on the list. Well, what can we do that? We have to make sure that you have sins that need to be forgiven. Well, how do we do that? If we want every person who's ever born on a list, then we baptize them at birth. And if they won't get baptized at birth, we make sure that it's so distasteful to not take part in infant baptism that everyone takes part in it. So we would actually persecute the parents if they wouldn't want to baptize their babies. And we'll tell everyone it's because they're so inhumane, they want their babies to go to hell, but really we want everyone to follow steps so that we have an accurate census. And so now at all the churches in a particular civil rulership, you have these things known as baptismal registries. And so civil authorities would use those baptismal registries because little Johnny and Susie, we didn't want them to go to hell, so we got them baptized to wash away their sins. And so all the Johnnies and Susies whose parents didn't want to go to hell are on these baptismal registries in every little hamlet on the map. And now if you want to tax people, where's a good place to go to get the names? The churches. Good. Well, Michael Servetus is not only then affecting doctrine, he's affecting what? Structure, and more importantly, money. When you start talking about baptism of babies going away, now how in the world are we going to know that everybody who's ever been born in this city is on a registry? Well, that's a problem, isn't it? Because then we can't tax them. Number four, three. The Council of Nicaea was heretical, is what Michael Servetus says. Servetus says it's heretical for promoting the doctrine of the Trinity. That happened in what year? The Council of Nicaea? It's the first great council. 1,200 bishops, maybe 1,800, almost 2,000 bishops from both Eastern and Western Roman Empire were called together into Nicaea to have a council of the bishops. 300 showed up. One out of six bishops in the Roman Empire showed up to this Council of Nicaea, where they discussed, among other things, whether or not Jesus was God, because of a certain guy by the name of Arius, who said that Jesus was not God. Jesus was just simply the revelation of God in the flesh. Sounds a lot like Servetus, doesn't it? And so Servetus looks back and he agrees with a guy named Arius. Yeah, Arius. That's right. He looks back and he sees a guy named Arius who was basically, being recorded here, so basically dumped on for believing that Jesus was not God, but rather that Jesus was merely the Son of God. Big difference in their minds. All right, so, number four. He did not believe in infant baptism. Why? Because the baby doesn't believe diddly. Why are we baptizing him? Yeah, there's nothing to repent of if you're a baby. And so anyway, that's that. Number five, he was a rambunctious letter writer. He was by no means satisfied when he wrote that book that you saw in the film. He sent a part of it to John Calvin. And John Calvin, for lack of a better term, is the head of what we now know as the Presbyterian Church. You might as well just say it. I mean, effectively, even if he didn't start the church called the Presbyterian Church, he was pretty much the most instrumental guy in the history of the Presbyterian Church. Many would say he was the starter of it all. Well, here's Michael Servetus. He sends, as you heard in the film, a copy of his new book on the Trinity to John Calvin with a different name. And John Calvin is not feeling good about this guy from Spain and France. disregarding what has always been orthodox doctrine, at least since 325 when the Council of Nicaea said that Jesus was eternally begotten. See? So, he had a problem with that, and he wrote John Calvin. John Calvin told him what he thought. He didn't really know Servetus that well until Servetus started mailing him letters asking for clarifications on doctrine. And Calvin, like a diplomatic man, would answer some of the questions piecemeal. And Servetus decided that he wasn't happy. Servetus was by no means, this is from, this is from Philip Schaff's History of the Christian Church, Volume 8. Servetus was by no means satisfied with Calvin's answers, and he wrote back that Calvin made two or three sons of God, that wisdom of God spoken by Solomon was nothing but allegorical and impersonal, that regeneration took place in a moment, but never in infant baptism. He denied that circumcision corresponded to baptism. He put, and as a matter of fact, here's basically the bottom line. Every time Calvin would respond to Servetus' letter, Servetus would come back, it seems, angrily with even more questions. So here's Calvin. He's kind of responsible for keeping the peace along with the Senate of Geneva. And this guy named Michael Servetus, who doesn't pastor anywhere as far as we know, he's a physician, not a theologian. Yes, he's smart, went to university what age?
13.
Very good. But he's just being kind of a pain. And he's writing these irritating letters to Calvin. And so now, Servetus is starting to gain a following. People are starting to believe what Servetus believes. Now, what happens when you have two groups of people that believe two different things in the same area? What is going to end up happening?
Conflict.
And what do they have in Geneva? A theocracy. Well, if God's leading, you can't have conflict. It sort of doesn't make sense. Usually supposed to have peace. Well, the theocracy is being challenged. Now, number next, Servetus was already causing trouble with Calvin and civil unrest. So he escaped from France and thought, you know what, I'll bet I can find some parlay in Calvin's world. I'm going to go to his church, but unfortunately he was recognized. And so here's what Calvin says. Servetus is still alive. He has not been arrested yet. Here's what Calvin says in his commentary on the Gospel of John. As God in creating the world revealed himself by speech, so he formerly had concealed himself. Servetus, a haughty scoundrel belonging to the Spaniards, invented the statement that his eternal speech began to exist at that time when he was displayed in the creation of the world, as if he did not exist before his power was made known by eternal operation. Now, what I'm trying to get you to see, by the way, is that John Calvin, many people's hero today, before Servetus was even arrested, before Servetus even showed up in Geneva, John Calvin did not like him. Here's a commentary that predates the death of Servetus, where John Calvin says, Servetus is a scoundrel. And he's a heretic. Listen to what he says. I'm fully aware how this dog barks against us and what cavils are formally raised by the Arians, namely that in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, which nevertheless are not eternal because the word beginning refers to order instead of denoting eternity. So again, the purpose of this lesson on Servetus is not to get you straight on the deity. The purpose of this lesson is to show you that the first well-known modern-day Unitarian was killed much at the behest of John Calvin. Servetus dies being burned at the stake in Geneva. Now, John Calvin argued for beheading instead of burning at the stake. Well, that sounds pretty humane, doesn't it? I mean, if he's going to die anyway, you have a city council in Geneva that wants Servetus killed. Let's go through it again. Why does he want Servetus killed? Why do they want Servetus killed? He's challenging the theocracy by doing what? By causing what? Conflict, or what we might call civil unrest. Yep, good. Civil unrest. He's doing this because he's creating two different kinds of beliefs. The one, he's creating a second one, I should say, which is the one that's not the official one. Not state church. He doesn't believe you get saved by being baptized. What does that tell you about John Calvin? That he did. Remember, if you're state church, you have to have a way to get people into that church. That is why the Lutherans believed in infant baptism, because you had to have a way to get the state into the church. That's why the Presbyterians believed in infant baptism, because originally you had to have a way to get people into the state church. So Catholics, Presbyterians, Lutherans, they had to have a way to get people of the state into the church because it's a state church. So how do you do that? Baptism. Well, now Servetus is causing trouble because they don't believe in that. Calvin does. Calvin believes there is some value, saving value, in infant baptism. Now then, the Geneva Senate wants that unrest taken care of, and so they want to burn him at the stake as a religious heretic. Well, it turns out that Calvin particularly wanted him to be burned, have his head cut off instead of being burned at the stake. And here's why. Because religious heretics were burned at stakes. Civil people who cause civil unrest, or how should we say, people who disturb the peace, thank you, they had to be killed by a normal political means. Capital punishment had to be carried out in another way. If religious heretics are burned at the stake, well then people who cause problems for political settlements need to be killed differently. Beheadings. Hangings. So why would John Calvin be more interested in Servetus dying instead of in the flames, he dies with a sword? Why?
Because that would make him a martyr.
It would make him a martyr for a new faith. Good job, Austin. Why else?
He recognizes that it's more civil than religious.
That's right, he's causing civil unrest. And if you start putting religious heretics to death in Geneva, what do you start looking like? What's happening south? They what? The Catholic Church is doing what? And how are they killing people? Burning them at the stake. We don't want a theocracy looking like the great whore of Rome. We have to look differently in how we're killing people. So we want it to look like that there's not martyrdom happening over here because we're soiling men's conscience. We don't want it to look like we're killing religious people over here like they're doing it over there. I mean, God knows that if you put a Presbyterian in Spain or France, they would have been burned at the stake. And so here you have in Geneva, you have a man who's none of those, nor is he's not Catholic, he's not Lutheran, he's not what we would call Presbyterian. And so if we want to put him to death, it's going to look like we're doing exactly what the Catholics are doing. And that is not allowing someone to believe what their conscience tells them to be true. So while some will say Calvin was being very, very, very humane, no, the truth is he was being very, very politically savvy. And then we find out from our friend Justo Gonzalez in the Story of Christianity, Volume 2, that after the death of Servetus, Calvin and Calvinism had almost no opponent in that part of the world. Why? Because look what happens if you disagree. You die. And so, for a period of time, there was political and religious rest. The point of this lecture today was not to get you to be Unitarian. The point of this lecture today was to show you that when it looks like someone is dying for being a heretic, not only does it look Catholic, but behind it is a lust for control and money. I hope you learned something today. Any questions? Yes?
Do you think that Servetus...
Servetus?
Servetus, yeah, something like that. That he was kind of, he knew, like, that he wanted, like, after, like, he already knew that he was burned to stake, that he knew that being a martyr would make the religion stronger.
I don't know. I think that was more an issue if he just couldn't say he believed something when he didn't. He just didn't believe it, so he just couldn't bring himself to say he believed something. They even let him try to, they even wanted him to recant just prior to his execution. Yes, ma'am.
I think I remember from somewhere, is it true that Beloved, you know, Forgotten 316 that you were saying, it has...
Begotten?
Or Forgotten, it has a alternative death? definition to it. And that's why that other definition validates the statement that Jesus has existed eternally.
Sure, it can certainly have a wide meaning that includes making someone your son. So the question is, when was he made God's son? If he wasn't originally, either created being or not a created being. There are some who are Christians who would say that he wasn't always God's son, even though he was the second person of the Trinity, and he became God's son on the day of his begotten name. The problem is, I don't find enough clarity in Scripture that tells me when that happened.
I thought there was a second definition, like begotten son, as in like the one who just...
Proceeds from,
or like... kind of with the whole Judaism, the birthright, and all like that.
Right. Well, at some point, if you read Hebrews chapter 1, there is that, and that is what happened to Christ. When he ascended to heaven, he was declared to be the Son of God, the begotten Son of God, and given an inheritance. So there is a Jewish tone to that, yes. But how can you give a begotten Son if he hasn't been begotten yet, is the whole point of John 3:16. You know? So we're not talking about a resurrection or an ascension thing. We're talking about a son who was already begotten when the Father gave him. You know what I'm saying? All right, so tomorrow.